Hello, and welcome to Profiles, a program that introduces to WFIU listeners interesting people from Indiana, the United States, and the world. I'm Owen Johnson. On this occasion, we welcome Mark Crispin Miller, a media critic and commentator, and a professor of media ecology at New York University. He is the editor most recently of Loser Take All, Election Fraud and the Subversion of Democracy, 2000 to 2008. Which was published in 2008. Mark, welcome to Profiles.
Thanks, Owen. It's great to be here.
Media ecology. What exactly is media ecology?
The fact that you have asked me that, along with many, many hundreds of other people, has something to do with the fact that we changed the name of the program to Media, Culture, and Communication. Basically, media ecology is a notion based on Marshall McLuhan's thought, and it refers to the idea that every dominant medium creates its own kind of world. So you got print culture and you have oral culture and so on. So that's where that came from. And I guess it's a little bit passé. So as I say, we've updated the title of the program.
How did you get into this field?
Well, actually, I ended up writing about media sort of gradually. My own background is more literary and aesthetic. I got a PhD in English in the 70s at Johns Hopkins. My field was the Renaissance, or what we then called the Renaissance. Now I guess they call it early modern Europe. I was, you know, very much interested in Shakespeare, and I wrote a dissertation on courtliness, the notion of courtliness in Shakespeare, and Castiglione, who wrote the Book of the Courtier. While I was doing that kind of work, which I loved, I was also teaching and writing about American film, kind of on my own. There were no film courses being taught at Hopkins, so I taught some as a graduate instructor, and I wrote some essays on a few new movies. This was the mid-70s, which in retrospect, you know, strikes me as one of the golden ages of American film, the period of The Godfather and Chinatown and those great, great movies. But to make a long story short, when I went to teach, my first job was at Penn, and my course load was divided between courses on Shakespeare and courses on the movies. Well, in studying film, and especially in teaching it, I became increasingly interested in close analysis of visual images and consideration of all that they can say to us that we don't necessarily notice consciously. That led me to start to look critically at things like TV commercials and political spectacle and so on. So while I was doing my academic work, you know, I had a piece in Milton Studies, for example, on A Passage in Paradise Lost. I was also starting to write for magazines like The New Republic and The Nation about what some might call pop culture, mass culture, TV, politics, stuff like that. So when the Reagan era began, I was, you know, in a perfect position to talk about a presidency that was conceived in spectacular terms as a big show for people to watch, very carefully scripted. And that got me thinking about propaganda American style. So when I left Penn, I was tempted to go to Berkeley. I had been offered a job there, which is a place I'd always wanted to go. But they made clear to me in the English department there that while they were amused by the things I was writing,
it wasn't serious?
It wasn't, well, it wasn't a tenure, it wasn't a tenurable offense, as it were, you know. And I guess I wanted the job security, so With some ambivalence, I decided to go back to Hopkins and teach in what's called the writing seminars there. And that's the creative writing program. But because Hopkins is a very traditional university, curricularly speaking, everything that doesn't fit into a traditional discipline is in the writing seminars. So it's not just creative writing, but it's journalism, it's drama, it's film studies, you name it. So I went there in 1982. And devoted myself to writing about media and also became involved in local media issues. I had a radio show on the what was then the NPR affiliate in Baltimore, WJHU, which Hopkins had bought. I ran a film series at the Baltimore Museum. The fact of the matter is I moved away completely from literary study, which had in any case, it seemed to me, become so abstrusely theoretical that it no longer really appealed to me. Because I guess at heart I'm a practical critic. I mean, I try to interpret works to see how much more meaningful we can find them to be once we've, you know, really, really studied them carefully. So my first book was called Boxed In, The Culture of TV. It came out in 1988. It was a collection of essays on different media moments, TV commercials, Charles and Diana's royal wedding, Ronald Reagan, the Jerry Lewis telethon, A Family Feud, the old one with Richard Dawson, you know. And I'm very proud of those pieces. I think they're quite good. But this was a collection of close readings of what you might call little texts from the media spectacle. I became increasingly aware while I was doing this work in the late 70s and early 80s that the media landscape was itself becoming increasingly concentrated and corporatized, so that it seemed less and less helpful to be intensively analyzing particular moments on the screen. And I became more of an activist for what you might call democratic media reform, to try to...
Small D
Democrats. Absolutely small D, because the big D Democrats are just as bad as the big R Republicans at enabling the media business to become this grotesque cartel that's dominated by like five multinational corporations and has no, you know, concern for public interest or anything like that. So I spent a few years, I started a nonprofit called the Project on Media Ownership. And basically our goal was to make people aware of who owned what, and aware also of the consequences of that kind of excessive corporatization of the press in a democratic society. Well, you can look around now and see how incredibly successful I was at spotlighting that issue, right? It was, I really feel that I can rest on my laurels. Anyway, we did what we did, and the consolation I can take from having done that work is that I turned out to be right about the dire effects of, a hyper-commercial, overly corporatized media system. Not just the news, by the way, Owen, but also the movie business, the music business, the book publishing business, which is, you know, in very big trouble even as we speak. It's just not good for a democracy or a culture of any kind to have a media system that's dominated by a handful of debt-ridden commercial entities. So I started to work a few years ago on a book about the Marlboro Man, to kind of return to my origins as a culture critic and, you know, media analyst. I edited a series for Yale University Press called Icons of America. These are, you know, books dedicated to a fresh kind of study of iconic images and texts from American history. The first book in the series was Gore Vidal's Inventing a Nation, which is about the Founding Fathers. We've had books about the hamburger, books about Wall Street, books coming out about Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech and the Little Red Schoolhouse and Andy Warhol, you name it. Anyway, my own contribution to this series is this book on the Marlboro Man, which I'm about halfway through. But a funny thing happened to us all on my way to completing this book, and that was the election of 2000.
Okay. Before we get to the election of 2000, I want to come back to one thing about that book on Boxed In, on the culture of TV. That was written when TV was still dominant, no internet. Well, the internet existed, but it wasn't popularly used. Would you write a different book now because of the internet, or are the basics still the same?
That's a very good question. Not only was this TV pre-internet, but it was also TV pre-cable. I mean, there was cable, but
yeah,
very
CNN,
few people.
But not too much more than that.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't get it, and I didn't know anybody who did get CNN, but it was still network dominated. Yeah, the landscape has changed enormously since then. And I think the most important way in which it's changed is that when I wrote those essays some 30 years ago, I guess it is, it was still possible to construct a visual moment or an audiovisual moment with great care that you could be reasonably confident would make some kind of impression on the public. Since then, the spectacle of TV, et cetera, has become so dense and hysterical and tumultuous and, you know, sensationalistic that it's actually harder now to find such moments that would yield anything to a careful reading. In other words, the experience of mass media now is so much more degraded and debased. I mean, just since those years, for example, the amount of explicit gore and sadistic violence just in regular primetime TV is staggering. Likewise, the use of scatological devices to get a laugh in movies and on TV, and even in kids' books. I mean, I'm talking here about a...
There's a whole series, I think, of kids' books that deal with these devices.
That's exactly right. As a father, I know this all too well. There's been an enormous coarsening of the spectacle for, you know, I think fundamentally for sort of economic reasons. As people become more and more inured to the stimuli of just a few years ago, it becomes necessary to sort of jolt them with ever stronger and coarser kinds of shocks and appeals. So that now most TV commercials, you know, I let me back up for a moment. You know, I have some readings of TV commercials and boxed in. These things were, I mean, they were terribly dishonest. I mean, they were deceptive propaganda and so on. But a great deal of ingenuity went into crafting every visual moment, you know, so you could actually sit carefully, watch and unpack it and see what it was really saying. Sometimes the statements that one of those things would make would be just amazing, you know, amazingly revealing and kind of perverse. Now, increasingly, what TV commercials are there to do is simply grab your attention before it fades, you know, so that a jolting first impression, simply to make an impression on you, is practically the whole strategy. There's nothing really much beyond that. So it's like a slap across the face or a knee to the groin, I guess is a more appropriate simile there. But it would be hard to find moments to write about now in the way that I wrote about them then. Now the whole thing is, I don't care how brilliant any writer is, I don't think there is a writer in the world who could find the language to capture what it is we inhabit, what it is we're immersed in day after day after day. So, yeah, things have changed enormously. And part of that is that the TV networks, for example, have lost a lot of viewers. Radio has lost a lot of listeners. Newspapers have lost a lot of readers. Magazines have lost readers. And I do believe that this is an unconscious mass rejection of media fare that's churned out without any real aesthetic or, you know, intellectual justification.
I suppose one could say that all this attention of particularly younger people to Facebook, to texting, to individual communication on the phones is in effect they are saying, we're not passive, we're going to do our own thing and forget about this mainstream media.
Well, yeah, there is a great deal of that, you know, do-it-yourself spirit involved in this shift away by the young, you know, from traditional media towards new media. I have a Facebook page. I have a blog. You know, I'm completely into it, and I think that there's a lot of good to be said for it. At the same time, I'm not, you know, someone who believes that this is the way to utopia because I am struck by how effectively the new media serve as blinders, you know, as a kind of opaque helmet. You can customize your own media experience. Well, one ought to have mixed feelings about that, because when you customize your own daily experience of the world by choosing to absorb it through a particular kind of media screen, you're inevitably going to miss a lot that might come to you just by happenstance. You know, it's a little bit like the difference between hunting for a book on the shelves of a library or a bookstore and going right to it online. Because I'm sure you've had the same experience. How many times have you found a book you didn't expect to find, you didn't even know existed, it's just sitting there? That's life, you know. That's life. That's a good thing. You know?
Yeah, when you're going down the street with iPod in your ears and you're texting, you're not seeing
you're not
or hearing
there.
Anything else.
And unfortunately, sometimes you're at the wheel, you know. I have to say, you know, as a New Yorker now for the last 10 years or so, it kind of depresses me how many people are thus narcotized as they walk down the street on the phone or listening to an iPod. And they don't look particularly happy or anything, you know, but they're not there. You know, I've occasionally asked someone on the phone on the street for directions, you know, and you're not there. You don't exist. And that's I don't think that's a good thing, especially at a time when the whole question of our self-government is really pressing. I mean, we can get into that later. But all too often, these toys really don't help us communicate in any meaningful way. They're just a kind of distraction. You know, I think kids who can't really walk a half a block without calling somebody when they expect to meet them in two blocks, you know? And then they're waving at each other and talking. That's weird to me. But I think that there's an uneasiness about being left without any hookup, you know, without a voice in your ear, all by yourself in that void. You know, it's kind of an existential dread that people keep at bay by push. You know, they're all thumbs; they get their thumbs working. It may be presumptuous to say this about what people are doing, but it's a feeling I get.
But this is being recorded during an election year, so it's appropriate to turn to some of the material that you've written in connection with elections. And I find it fascinating that you had a book out about George Bush before it was fashionable to do so, that somehow or other in the 2000 election campaign you locked on to something that was really rather interesting. I think was it called Bush Dyslexicon, Observations on a National Disorder. How did you come to the topic?
Well, I came to the topic because I started listening to what Bush was saying and noticed something that I thought was not only extremely revealing and important, but something that people were failing to notice because they were so busy laughing at his funny way of talking. And I noticed, too, that the laughter at his malapropisms and so on was something that his campaign was encouraging because it helped them to represent him as a man of the people. You know, unlike stuffy Al Gore, George W. Sixpack here is just a regular guy. You know, I mean, of course, Bush's family could have bought and sold the Gores many times over, and Bush was a Yale graduate. It was a ridiculous thing to, you know, suggest about him. Moreover, his way of talking was not in any sense a recognizably colloquial way of talking. I mean, no factory workers talk like that, you know. It's a language all his own. But the thing that was, I think, really significant about his speech was and is that he only made those hilarious mistakes of his when he was trying to speak about certain subjects or in a certain key that was alien to him. On the other hand, on certain other subjects and in a particular other key, his language was fine. His off-the-cuff spoken English, his unscripted discourse was fine, grammatically and syntactically quite clear. And basically, Bush would blow it You know, his tongue would go AWOL when trying to sound an altruistic or idealistic note, or when trying to speak about education or peace or, you know, economic justice or, you know, anything constructive. That's when he would say hilarious things inadvertently, like, I know how hard it is for you to put food on your family. You know, it's one of my favorites. He did not say those kinds of things, for example, after 9/11. You know, once he got his footing, because the first couple of days, of course, was a failure for him as a performer. But once he got his footing, whether his speeches were scripted or his remarks were unscripted, he was perfectly clear. And in fact, the more menacing and bellicose his speech became as he was selling the war in Iraq, the more coherent and lucid his English was. I mean, the thought behind it was kind of insane, and the assumptions were all screwed up. But there was nothing to laugh at. See, the irony for me was that, you know, here's this book on his peculiar way of talking that came out in June of 2001, and the book did quite well. In fact, it did better than any other book I've ever written. It was widely misconceived as a humor book, and it was shelved with humor books at, say, Barnes & Noble. What it is, it's got a long introduction, and then there's different chapters according, you know, each one is about a different subject that he would talk about. Then I would just give examples of his speech and then little analyses of what he'd said. It's a serious book, and it ended, you know, the subtitle, as you note, Observations on a National Disorder. The concluding essay deals with the fact that the press was wholeheartedly supportive of him despite his manifest weaknesses and his dubious connections and his extreme agenda, and covered for him and so on. So that this was not just a book about a particular guy and his funny way of talking. It was a book about an entire establishment kind of collaborating on letting him become president. Although, as we did not know at the time, we didn't know till November of 2001, Al Gore actually was the winner in Florida, which is a fact many people to this day don't know. At any rate, the book came out in June. It did quite well. It was well received by the press, which is unusual for me, because we have to remember that by the summer of 2001, Bush was in big, big trouble. He was, you know, way down there in the approval ratings, and people were really sort of sorry he was president. On 9/10, I was on MSNBC talking about it prime time. Well, with 9/11, it suddenly became almost criminal to criticize him. And this was simply a function of the mass panic that event threw the nation into.
Probably Phil Donahue's disappearance from the networks was an example.
Exactly.
Of the same thing.
Exactly. Across the board, people go infantile when they're frightened. That's why terrorism works. And people went infantile after that event. I think that the general population stayed that way for, you know, 8 months to a year. But certainly the press stayed that way for several years, very deferential and very eager to forgive him everything and to see heroism and Churchillianism where there was none. But, of course, that meant that the book was finished. And the irony for me is that the argument I was making was more relevant than ever, because the line about Bush now was he has found his voice, he has grown in this moment of tribulation, he has become the leader we need. Well, that wasn't true. The fact is he could now speak in terms of revenge, and that suits him. If he had done what almost all national security experts worldwide were saying ought to have been done, and which to this day is a kind of forbidden alternative. If he had treated this as a criminal act and not an act of war, and had looked for the perpetrators the way we looked for the guys who blew up the World Trade Center the first time, right, in 93, it probably would have been a successful manhunt. We would have brought the perpetrators to justice or killed them, right? It would have cost a lot less blood and money in the long run. It would have made such a difference as to be hard to, you know, sum it up in words. But that was the narrative that the press and the people seemed to want. And nobody wanted to hear me weigh in and say, no, this is not a sign that Bozo has turned into Winston Churchill. This is something else. You know, this is something that Bush likes, you know. I mean, to be fair to him, he also likes to talk about baseball. And when he talks about baseball, he's very clear. When he talks politics, he's very clear, you know. But it's usually invidious. It's usually antagonistic, angry. It's Manichaean, you know. It's us against them. So that's what happened with that book. And in fact, as a result of what was in essence a blackout on at least my work about him, I decided to take to the stage. I mean, I couldn't get any interviews anywhere or bookstore appearances. So I started to do a kind of political stand-up.
Was this the one called A Patriot Act?
Well, A Patriot,
or did that come later?
Well, A Patriot Act came out of this because at first I just rented a theater, the Cherry Lane Theater in the West Village in New York, and invited people, you know, by email. And they came and I talked about politics. And then it gradually took shape, and I met a terrific director named Gregory Keller, who actually directs operas at the Met. And he and I worked together on turning it into a real show. At the same time, some people from the New York Theater Workshop, which is across town, it's in the East Village, came to see me perform and then invited me to do a proper show on their stage. And, you know, they helped me develop it. And that became A Patriot Act, which I performed in the summer of 2004. And it's a team of filmmakers also made a movie, which people can get at patriotnation.us on DVD. It's really quite a good movie. I continue to do performances from time to time in New York. And that, you know, here we're sitting talking about media, internet, TV and stuff. But, you know, basically, there is nothing quite like talking to people directly on a stage or at a lectern. There's nothing quite like doing radio. And there's nothing quite like a book, you know. So if and when, God forbid, the big breakdown comes and energy is priced out of everybody's reach, we could conceivably return to these tried and true old media forms without too much suffering.
We have to call that when old media were new, kind of title. I think this is, before we go more specifically to some other aspects of politics and the elections past and forthcoming, I think it's time to stop and listen to some music that you like. How did you come to choose this music and what does it mean to you?
I've been thinking about this question, which I knew you were going to ask in the middle of the show. And I guess I'd like people to listen to Strawberry Fields Forever by the Beatles. The music of the 60s had a profound effect on me. That whole moment had a profound effect on me because it was a utopian moment. You know, it was a moment not only of extraordinary musical diversity and beauty and creativity, Britain and here in the States, but it was a moment when people really believed in realizing some of, you know, the most important ideals, including those on which the founding of our republic was based, actually. So I'm picking a song that's particularly dark and unusual, suggestive by, you know, John Lennon, who was one of my heroes, because it's a song about what it really feels like to sense that one's sort of out of touch with the world around one, that the world is, it's, there's something wrong with it, and yet you wonder if maybe there's not something wrong with you. Is it your fault? You know, it raises questions like that, and it's just a great song, so that's what I want people to listen to.
let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Field.
That was Strawberry Fields by the Beatles, music chosen by our guest today, media critic Mark Crispin Miller. You're listening to Profiles on WFIU. This is being recorded in October of 2008, the third very challenging election that we've had in a row. One of your books dealt with the 2000 and 2004 elections. When did you become concerned about the way that the counting of the election ballots might not have gone according to the way it was supposed to?
Well, I was already worried about the use of electronic voting machines, I think as early as 2002. I had a friend who alerted me to some troubling facts about that system. And I remember I had a conversation with John Kerry in December of 2003 when he was just one of many contenders for the Democratic nomination. I got myself invited to a fundraiser for him at George Plimpton's house in New York with the express purpose of urging him to, not just to be cautious about the machines but to bring it up as an issue. And he was visibly uninterested in what I was saying, and I could read in his eyes that he thought I was nuts, a crank, trying to be polite. Ran his hand over his hair and, put on a solemn face. I could see it go in one ear and out the other. I got a very different response from, Mrs. Kerry, who seemed to be very passionate about the subject. My concern with the elections kicked into high gear immediately after the 2004 election, which struck me right away as that outcome struck me as inexplicable. I wasn't a particularly enthusiastic Kerry supporter. I certainly did vote against George W. Bush, along with many Republicans, I might add, because the Republican opposition to his reelection was considerable. I'm not even a Democrat. I'm an independent. But on no basis did the official story of this election make any sense. So simply on empirical grounds, it struck me as impossible that he was elected with 11.5 million more votes than he'd gotten last time. And it seemed to me so obvious. This, in a way, is the story of my life, It seemed to me so obvious that I thought, well, I'm just going to start talking to other people who also see that this is the case, and, we're going to investigate, and we got to do something because we have to fix the election system regardless of your favorite party or candidate. Well, I was taken aback to discover that most people on the left were uninterested in and dismissive of all this evidence of fraud. I remember I did Al Franken's show on Air America 4 or 5 days after the election. I'd been a semi-regular guest on the show, and I went in there ready for a great conversation with him, comparing notes. And I went in, and he was stirring some, cream into his coffee there. Before we went on, and I said, let's do this, let's tackle the subject. And he said, we don't think that Kerry won this election. We think Bush won it. Use the royal plural. I says to myself, well, this is going to be an interesting show. So we sat down at our mics and we started talking about it. And I'm giving him examples of bizarre anomalies and improprieties. And at one point, I mentioned some Florida county where there were more votes cast than the number of people who lived there, right? And Bush won.
An old Chicago tradition.
No kidding. As an old Chicagoan, I'd seen a lot of this stuff happen. When Mayor Daley did it as a Democrat, the Bush people have brought this to a whole new level. Al Franken says. No. We checked that out. There's nothing to that. I said, you checked it out? Really? He said, yeah, we checked that out, and it turned out to be mumble, you know. Then his producer texted him on the computer, and Al says, looking at the screen, oh, here we go. Yeah, this is what we did. Yeah, we contacted the webmaster for the Secretary of State in Florida. And he assured us there was nothing to it. I'll never forget that. Oh, well, if they said there was nothing to it, you know, this represents a kind of abdication of responsibility and of even of just what, you know, sort of predictable partisan suspiciousness. You know, you expect Al Franken, this big liberal Democrat with, you know, at the time, senatorial designs, you'd think he'd go for this. But no, that's not how it's been happening at all, because the implications of what actually happened are so shattering, it seems to me, that a lot of people, especially within the establishment, especially media figures and journalists and even top Democrats, have shied away from what is by now an open and shut case.
Why have journalists not touched it?
Well, I know for a fact that a lot of journalists have wanted to touch it, but their editors don't want them to touch it. And I can't get any more specific because I don't get to talk to Pinch Sulzberger at the Times, you know what I mean? We don't lunch together. He's the publisher, and he has evidently let it be known somehow that this is not a subject they want to deal with. You know, I've talked to a number of people at the Times, and clearly there's discouragement from on high. Whether it's a directive or not, I don't know. But I've heard similar stories about some of the networks, and clearly there is an uninterest in
this. But isn't there a Seymour Hersh or something like that out there that would pick up the story on a more independent basis who has some strong credibility?
I guess the answer to that would seem to be no. I mean, I've talked to Seymour Hersh about it, big admirer of his, and his plate is full. He does foreign policy and he does the war. And he, you know, might have done it if it were his beat. But you know how journalists are. You know, the stories they break are the stories they break, and then they're not going to, you know, get into anything else. It is mysterious, actually, a lot of lesser-known journalists have done a fantastic job of unearthing crucial details. I mean, you know, we could do an entire show and then some just on the evidence of fraud. I can assert with perfect confidence that it's now an open and shut case that the 2004 election was stolen. But I don't ask people to take my word for it. You know, all they really need to do is just read some of the books that are out there. There are a couple of blogs I can mention. My own blog, markcrispinmiller.com, keeps track of all this stuff. And there's a whole bunch of books, you know, book covers on the blog. People can read them. There's Brad Friedman's blog, bradblog.com. There's a nonprofit called Velvet Revolution, which has actually been managing a lawsuit in Ohio whose expert witness, the witness who's driving this whole thing, is a guy named Stephen Spoonamore, who is a prominent expert on the detection of computer fraud and a conservative Republican, by the way. And who personally knows the people who've been pulling off the fraud since 2000 and has named them. And this has actually caused extreme consternation within Karl Rove's circle. This guy's completely solid. This is my shorthand way of telling your listeners that it's not a matter of speculation or so-called conspiracy theory, you know, as it is with some of the claims made by the 9/11 truth movement, whose people often jump from inadequate official explanations to assertions that the Bush administration was behind what happened. I don't believe you can do that. this is different. Here we have open and shut evidence of systematic fraud and vote suppression on a massive scale throughout this decade. The fraud and vote suppression of the same general kind that both parties have engaged in throughout our history, indeed, but on a scale vastly greater, in a far more systematic and consistent way, using technology that makes a lot of it undetectable, which is fairly new, and to a great extent ideologically driven by a real hatred of democracy, which you can't say about the kind of fraud that, say, Mayor Daley pulled off or Lyndon Johnson, you know, in his early days in Texas. That was just old-fashioned greed and power lust, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, what? Lyndon Johnson, as I recall, won by 34 votes or something like that in one of his Senate campaigns.
There you go. Landslide Lyndon. I mean, it's human nature to try to steal elections. But for some bizarre reason, many prominent people, journalists and politicians here in this country now, seem to retreat behind the notion that it can't happen here. And I don't see why it can't. I don't see why it can't happen here any more than it can happen anywhere else. And indeed, you know, I have to say this, you know, that getting into this subject has deepened my interest in our own history and my respect for the radicalism of our founding, you know. I mean, I'm not at all convinced by the Charles Beard thesis that the Constitution was a massive plot by the wealthy to keep commoners in their place. I mean, I think on the one hand that thesis has been discredited on many different bases since, but it also distracts us from those aspects of the Constitution and certainly our revolution that were and remain extremely radical: the separation of church and state, the freedom of speech, system of checks and balances. These things are precious, you know. Now, because of the way we're taught our own history in school, in this kind of anodyne, apolitical way, where we treat everything as an icon, you know, and we're just supposed to bow our heads and honor it, you know, without understanding it. I mean, all of that has blinded us to what's really vital here in our history and what's at grave risk. So this is, you know, in no sense a left-right issue unless you consider popular self-government and the right to vote left-wing. You know, if you have that monarchist sort of worldview, okay, then that's left-wing. But I have found that the left, by and large, is AWOL on this issue. They are not among the people who are fighting this fight. In fact, a number of the most heroic figures in this movement are Republicans, clearly not on board with, you know, this particular administration. But then again, there's nothing conservative about this administration. You know, it's doing something else.
What about the 2008 campaign we've had in the Democratic primary? A woman and a man of mixed race. We had in the Republican primary, we had a Mormon, we had a Baptist preacher. Is this a sign of a democratizing, more open America, or is this a continuation of trends that you've seen in the last two elections?
Well, no, it's not just a continuation of prior trends. There's two ways to answer this. In the first place, it's reason for, you know, celebration, and reflects the fact that a certain set of bigoted beliefs, a certain set of nationalistic and racial myths, are on the way out. That's simply a fact of life. We are becoming, inevitably, a more pluralistic and tolerant society. That fact has been obscured by these misleading election results, which consistently seem to hand the victory to a fringe movement, a Republican Party base that's only been the base of that party since the 90s. This is not your grandfather's Republican Party, in other words. This is an extremist party.
So we can't use the term GOP anymore?
Well, I do use it, but you have to use it with invisible quotation marks around it. I think one of the reasons why the base of that party, you know, the Christianist right wing, is so militant and zealous in trying to fulfill its mission is because they're fighting a losing battle. They're basically going against the tide of history, and you just can't do that. Someone like Sarah Palin is really a dinosaur. I mean, I know she thinks that they were around in the Garden of Eden, but I mean, you know, all easy jokes aside, she, for all her fresh face, you know, great legs and all the rest of it, she's a dinosaur and represents a whole set of attitudes that are on the way out. So the candidacies of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama are simply reflections of what I'm talking about. However, I always have to remind people that the official results of any of our elections are no solid grounds for drawing conclusions about anything, because if you look into what actually happened at the grassroots level and with the voting machines, it's a little like looking into the kitchen of a fancy restaurant. You know, it's not an appetizing experience. But take, for example, the New Hampshire primary, which brought Hillary Clinton's campaign apparently roaring back to life when she was, on life support, metaphorically speaking. Her poll numbers were quite low, and everyone I know who was in New Hampshire saw that her rallies were very sparsely attended, whereas Obama's were bursting at the seams, right? And then she wins. Amazingly enough, she wins. Well, it is worth noting that 16% of the vote in New Hampshire is hand-counted, and the other 84% are counted by computerized optical scanners. Worth noting also, therefore, that Barack Obama won the hand-counted votes by over 6 points. She won the machine-counted vote by over 5. Then a radio reporter in Connecticut who had an interest in the private company that programs all the optical scanners in New England, it's called LHS Associates, on a whim called some half a dozen town clerks' offices in New Hampshire and asked after the election, "Do you have any problems with your machines?" And they all said, "No, you know, we didn't, because someone from LHS came by before Election Day and fixed them and said they were going to work fine now." Now, that's completely illegal, okay? But aside from that, it's just very suspicious. The fact is that the Republicans control the machines nationwide. I mean, the machines are even there because of Republican legislation. And it seems to me quite clear that Hillary Clinton got a boost from the machines. What we saw in the New Hampshire primary in 2008 was not unlike what we saw in the New Hampshire primary in 1972, when Nixon's team, and I can't give you the term they used to describe themselves because it is a profanity, messed with the system in the old-fashioned way in order to knock Muskie out of contention and run against George McGovern. They basically engineered the candidacy of George McGovern through dirty tricks. Well, in 2008, I believe they did the same thing in New Hampshire. And there is strong evidence that in at least 5 other states where Hillary Clinton seems to have won, the machines gave her an advantage of between 5 and 7 points. So what I'm saying is, while it looked like a historic race because of a black man and a woman running neck and neck, it really wasn't that. It was a primary season in which a black man was doing extraordinarily well. And on the Republican side, there are a number of people, supporters of Ron Paul, members of his campaign, who have noted that many of his votes vanished, you know. So I am optimistic as far as the, dare I say, evolution of the public is concerned. People become more tolerant and enlightened and less bedeviled by, you know, preposterous notions about race and so on. But extremely concerned about the fact that our election system has been so expertly rigged.
One issue that we'll need to talk about very, very briefly is to what degree in 2008 do you think religion has played a part compared to previous years? Sarah Palin's nomination, probably the most critical thing in the general election.
Yeah, well, Sarah Palin was picked precisely to galvanize the religious right, which has detested John McCain for quite a long time. And I believe that the purpose of doing so is to then allow the Republicans to say, in the event of a surprising victory, that they all turned out for McCain and elected him. That's what they said about Bush in 2004. As I point out in detail in my book, Fooled Again, that whole notion of a Christian surge in 2004 was a myth. It didn't happen. There's no evidence that it happened. There's only evidence that it did not happen. So I don't think that religion played a major role in the 2004 election. It did play a major role in the spin on that election afterwards, you see. But the fact is, I think this is what you're getting at. The religious far right, the theocratic right in this country, has wielded an influence vastly disproportionate to its actual numbers, you see. There are many evangelicals who don't subscribe to the rapture ideology. There are many evangelicals who may subscribe to it who aren't that wild about Bush Cheney. And as the economy worsens, there are evangelicals who respond to that set of issues. I mean, they're people just like everybody else, and their motives are therefore mixed and complicated. But the fact is that the American people do not in any sense subscribe to that code, and the clearest evidence of that is the mass reaction to the Terry Schiavo episode.
That brings us to the conclusion of this conversation. Our guest today has been media commentator Mark Crispin Miller. Mark, thanks for this conversation.
Thanks, Owen. I really enjoyed it.
And to our listeners, we're pleased that you joined us. We close with more music chosen by Mark Crispin Miller. For WFIU, I'm Owen Johnson.
The program you have just heard was recorded in October of 2008. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.